mechanics and quantum reality. So we're going to try to understand what quantum mechanics says about reality. Albert Einstein, reality is merely an illusion, albeit a very persistent one. It just keeps coming up all the time. Lily Tomlin, reality is a crutch for people who can't cope with drugs. T.S. Eliot, humankind cannot stand very much reality. So, first of all, I'm going to talk about quantum measure theory. And in quantum measure theory, we start out with a measurable space, omega A. And so this is just a set of outcomes, and this is a set of events, a sigma algebra of events. And then we put a quantum measure on it. Unfortunately, this quantum measure is not an ordinary measure. An ordinary measure would be additive. The measure of a union would be the sum of the measures if they're disjoint. But that doesn't happen for a quantum measure. And so we have to contend with grade 2 additivity, which is a more general kind of additivity. So this is grade 2 additivity that a quantum measure has to satisfy. And we also have continuity conditions. This works for just a finite number of events, but if you have an infinite number of events, then you need these to be continuous. So it just says if you have an increasing sequence of events, then the measure of the union is the limit of the measures, and the decreasing sequence of events, the measure of the intersection is the limit of the measures. And we could...
Quick question. So if omega is a finite set, for instance, then A is just the set of all subsets.
Right. And then we don't need continuity. It just automatically holds. But if you have an infinite number, you got to have that continuity in order to have a decent measure. It's sort of like the difference between finite measures and infinite, countably additive measures and finitely additive measures. And here's a couple of conditions that aren't that important for us, really. There's a regularity condition that says if mu of A is 0, then mu of A union B, this means disjoint when there's a dot there, is measure of B. And if the measure of the union is 0, then the two measures are the same. Actually, I don't even think we're going to use this. But anyway, in many cases, one of these quantum measures comes from what's called a decoherence functional. And for us, a decoherence functional will just be a map from the set of events across the set of events to the complex numbers. And it kind of gives you the amount of interference between these two events, or at least the real part does anyway. And a decoherence functional will satisfy these conditions. It's essentially a measure in the first variable. It's symmetric, complex symmetric, greater than or equal to 0 on the diagonal, and this kind of Schwarz's inequality. And we'll also have to add continuity in order to get a quantum measure. So many of our quantum measures come from decoherence functionals in the following way. If you take a decoherence functional and you just look at its diagonal, you define mu of A to be DAA, then that turns out to be one of these regular quantum measures that I talked about before. And this is where most of them come from. And you see, in a certain way, why the real part of this decoherence functional tells you when when events interfere or not. If you take the quantum measure of A union B, but in terms of the decoherence functional, it looks like this. And so you get the usual additivity if and only if the real part is 0. So it says in a certain sense that the two events don't interfere if and only if this decoherence functional is 0. Let me give you a couple of examples of decoherence functionals. One looks like this. If you take a state, mixed state given by a density operator, and you have a positive operator valued measure, you look at the trace of W, positive operator valued measure at A and then at B, then that gives you a decoherence functional. And the corresponding quantum measure will just be the trace of W E of A squared. And another simpler example, which is actually a sub-example of this one, and if you just take an amplitude measure, that is a complex measure, and define the decoherence functional to be nu of A, whoops, that should be a nu there, nu of B bar, that's complex conjugate, then that's easily seen to be a decoherence functional, and the absolute value squared is a quantum measure, and that's how some quantum measures come about. Okay, let me give you another example. This is an example which I call particle-antiparticle pairs. It's just what you do is, I think I'm taking the unit interval. So here's the unit interval, 0, 1, and the real line. Can you see this? And take 1 fourth to 3 fourths. These will just be a bunch of particles. And a particle here, and if you add 3 fourths to it, that will be a corresponding antiparticle. And so the measure will be, you just take the Lebesgue measure, the length of the set minus the particle-antiparticle pairs, so annihilate each other, throw those out, that would be a quantum measure. So we don't need this anymore. Is this?
Hey, could I ask you a question about the previous slide where you defined the...
Up here.
No, the previous slide.
Oh, previous slide.
Yeah. You defined a decoherence functional quantum measure for a density operator where E was a positive operator value measure.
Right.
So when you get to the Q measure, you have trace of the density operator times the POV measure element squared.
Right, yeah, because you have E of A times E of A there.
So, but the POV measure, shouldn't it just be trace of the density operator times the element itself? Because if I sum over, if I integrate over the measure, then I would have expected that to be a measure only if it was trace W E of A. And maybe square roots in the decoherence functional expression.
I don't understand what you're saying. If you just fix this and let this variable A vary, then it'll be countably additive in this one variable. So it'll be a measure in A and also a measure in B. So is that what you're asking?
Maybe it won't be the standard quantum mechanical measure. I mean, those if you want to think of those as probabilities, I think is Rob's point.
This is not an ordinary probability.
It's not that.
This is a quantum probability. So this is not going to be additive, this mu.
Even when you take a set of disjoint A's that partition omega.
Yeah, I mean, if you take A union B, where A and B are disjoint, and then you have A union B here, that won't be the sum of mu of A plus mu of B, because it doesn't satisfy additivity.
But it's not the additivity I'm concerned with. Is it even normalized?
If this is a POV measure in which E of A is 1, the identity, then that would be normalized, yeah? Right? If E of omega is an identity, then that would just be trace of W. But we're not that concerned about normalization.
Normalized in the sense that if you add its values on a partition, it doesn't always have to give you the same number.
Yeah, it's not additive. But normalized usually means unital, yeah. Right?
It's one. In the second example, you do have that property, I presume.
Yeah, if nu of omega is 1, then this is normalized.
I mean, if you sum over all A, disjoint A,
right.
That equals 1, does it not?
No. I mean, this is not additive. You're squaring. You take the absolute value squared.
One usually thinks of that quantity as a probability. Probability is something like. So this is amplitude squared.
Yeah, it's the amplitude squared, which is not a probability.
It's because the nu is already additive. So the square of nu can't be additive.
Well, what was surprising is that I thought these examples were meant to reproduce the standard Born rule.
This is not a probability. This is not what one would call a quantum probability. This has this grade 2 additivity, which is more general than grade 1. So this is not going to give you a usual probability. It's more of an interference measure of interference. In other words, if the real part of, I guess, If you put in nu here, this would be twice the real part of nu of A times nu of B. That's your interference. That's your quantum interference. And this will be additive if and only if that's zero.
So can I say something else that may help them out with regard to the standard quantum example? I think that amplitude thing is the standard quantum example, but this measure has to do with, implicitly it's conditional on getting to a certain point at a screen that's beyond the measurement that you might think of as represented by these A's. And so, that doesn't have to be, the probability of getting to that part of the screen does not have to be the same for every partition, because there's different kinds of interference happening that direct probability to other parts of the screen that aren't represented by this measure. I think maybe that's one way.
And you really can't think of this as a probability. It's more like a propensity. It gives you like a propensity of something happening. But that's the terminology people use in order to not confuse it with being a probability. So the probability intuition goes away with these things because it has strange properties. I mean, you could have like an event A contained in an event B. Yet this quantum measure B is less than the quantum measure B could be less than A, and you could have strange things happen, like the quantum measure the whole space is zero. You have wild things happening with this, with these quantum measures, with these quantum measures.
Maybe one comment could be, this A represents an event, right? That could be a microscopic event in general. But in a special case where that is event is something you might call an instrument event or a pointer event, then one expects that this does reduce to the Born-Rolle probability. But that's a probability of some macroscopic event. And so there are people who work on decoherent histories, for example, are trying to show that in the end that you would reduce to the usual when you're dealing with a macroscopic event. But when you're not dealing with macroscopic or instrument events, then interference is important. Then there's no, as you were saying, there's no way that it's going to be additive, or no way that you can interpret it as a probability.
How does that reduction occur?
You could have a whole certain sets called macroscopic sets. It could act nicely. It could act like an ordinary measure on these macroscopic sets. So there could be some sets on which it does act in a nice way, like a probability. But if you have any interference, then it won't.
Basically, it occurs by some mechanism, which is certainly not thoroughly understood, as a lot of people have worked with it. Two alternative pointer locations, or two alternative macroscopic events, do not interfere with each other.
And mathematically, you would say that in those cases, mu of A becomes a regular probability measure. So it's trace of a density operator times an effect, not trace of a density operator times an effect squared. I guess I'm wondering, does this reduction mean that you lose the square in that equation?
No, it's more like, just in the middle of the gear, it's that DAB thing of equals zero, just in that case. It's just a special property of say, W and P. It's not that the equation changes.
It's especially classical.
Okay, all right, so here, this is another example of a quantum measure, this particle-antiparticle example in which the particles and antiparticles cancel each other out, and so the measure of the set is just the ordinary Lebesgue measure, and then you subtract off the particle-antiparticle pairs, and you can check that this is one of those quantum measures. Now, let me talk about something that we were already discussing. where does a quantum measure actually become a measure? And so I'll define A and B to be mu compatible, which I'll just write like this, if this quantum measure looks like a measure there. So, you know, an ordinary measure would satisfy A union B is measure of A plus measure of B minus measure of the intersection. So I'll call these events compatible if it looks like a measure on A and B. And then we'll call the mu center to be all of the A's that are compatible with every B. And another definition is we'll say that an event is splitting if mu of A can be written in two parts, the part in A plus the part in A complement. That's A complement. And there's a little theorem that says that it's mu splitting if and only if it's in the center. And if you look at the center, then you have a sigma algebra. And if you restrict mu to the center, then it's an ordinary measure. So on the center, this quantum measure is a real measure. And also, you got a generalization of additivity, countable additivity, whenever you stick to the center. Okay, and then in this particular example of the particle-antiparticle pairs, you can see what, in a very simple way, where the center is. The center is just all of the events that are compatible with their complement. And for example, well, and they, and that's equivalent to the measure of A plus the measure of A prime equal to a half. So examples of things in the center are the stuff in the middle here where there aren't any particle-antiparticle pairs, or an example that's not in the center is all of these particles that have corresponding antiparticles. Those aren't in the center. Okay, and oh, here's a characterization of these quantum measures. If you take a signed measure, so a signed measure is a measure that has can have negative values, and it's said to be symmetric if A cross B lambda is the same thing as lambda B cross A. And it's diagonally positive if A lambda of A cross A is non-negative. And it's pretty easy to check that if you have one of these diagonally positive symmetric sign measures on the product space, and you look at the diagonal, then that's a quantum measure. So this is another example of quantum measures. And it turns out that every quantum measure has that form. So given a quantum measure that always exists, in fact, a unique symmetric sign measure such that the measure is equal to lambda of A cross A. So it's kind of a characterization of quantum measures. They all look like measures on sign measures on the product space at their diagonal. Okay, so now we've talked about quantum measures. Now I want to talk about quantum integrals. As far as I'm concerned, measure theory isn't that interesting unless you also have an integral. Integrals are what makes the measure theory gives it some power and some interest. So I wanted to figure out how can I define a quantum integral. So I've got this quantum measure space right here. So that's just a set, sigma algebra subsets, and a quantum measure. And let's suppose we have a measurable function, non-negative. Then I'm going to define the quantum integral in this way. This took a little experimentation to figure that out, but I think this might be the good definition for a quantum integral. You just look at, this is called the tail sum formula in probability theory. This is used quite a bit in probability theory because frequently you have a random variable where you really don't know the values of the random variable. You don't know that much about the random variable, but you know the distribution of the random variable. So this is gives you, this is a distribution. It's called the tail distribution. It's the measure of the set on which the function is greater than or equal to some lambda. That's a real number. So that's a, like the probability of a tail in ordinary probability theory, the end of the random variable. Okay, you can show, okay, this is just a real valued function right here, real valued function of lambda. And you can show that it's measurable. And you can integrate it from 0 to infinity just with ordinary Lebesgue measure, integrate that, that's what I call the quantum integral. And in a while, we'll have another way of looking at the quantum interval, but this way is a good way to look at it because it's related to ordinary probability theory. And this just gives you the quantum integral for something that's not negative, but no problem. If it is negative, then you can just divide it up into its positive and negative parts and define the integral to be the difference of the integrals of the positive and negative parts. And as usual in integration theory, we define the integral over a set just to be the integral of the function times the characteristic function of that set. Of course, the characteristic function, that's 1 on A and 0 off of A. Now, this integral has some properties which I think are nice. One is that if mu happens to be an ordinary measure, then this just reduces to usual Lebesgue integral, which it should. And another is it has the property that if a function is non-negative, the integral is non-negative. It's homogeneous. You can pull constants out in front. And another property which one should have is that if you integrate a characteristic function, you just get the quantum measure of that set.
For this reduction to the usual case, do you need mu to be absolutely continuous with respect to the Lebesgue, or is it general?
No. If mu is a measure, then that's Lebesgue integral. Any measure.
Right.
Yeah, any measure. But what fails is additivity. I mean, you couldn't do everything that an ordinary integral has because we've got interference here. And this shouldn't be surprising because the measure itself is not additive, so the integral shouldn't be additive. So that's what you lose. And also you lose, this just follows directly from that, the integral of a union of disjoint sets is not the sum of the integrals. But we do have grade 2 additivity for the integral. remember, we had 3 disjoint sets. So for functions, the generalization of disjointness is disjoint support. So this says that if you integrate the sum of 3 measurable functions with disjoint support, then it satisfies that grade 2 condition that we had before for measures, but now we have it for integrals instead. So those are some of the properties of this quantum integral. Oh, yeah. And then this corollary here just shows that the usual integral of sum of disjoint sets is the sum of the integrals. Is this some water that I can drink? Hopefully. I'll just take a little out of here in this cup here. And just to some examples of this quantum integral. Oh, I guess first of all, there's a characterization here. Remember, I said that any quantum measure is a side measure on its diagonal. In other words, any quantum measure has this form for unique lambda. We could write the quantum integral in terms of this integral here. So it turns out that you can write the quantum integral as the following thing. You take the minimum of the function at omega prime, and then integrate it using that double integral. So that's another way of writing the quantum integral. And I had a lot of fun doing an example. So let's look at 0, 1 on the real line. And we'll take our quantum measure to be Lebesgue measure squared. So take the usual Lebesgue measure, square it. That's a quantum measure. And let's see what we can do by integrating with respect to this particular quantum measure, just as an example. So in this case, this measure is just Lebesgue measure cross Lebesgue measure, the product of Lebesgue measure with itself. So we can use that characterization that I have up here. So let's take 2 points on the real line between 0 and 1, a less than b, and then by this theorem here, the integral from a to b, that's just the notation instead of that notation there. Because of this, it's the minimum of the function at x, the function at y, dx dy. This is an ordinary Riemann integral if f is continuous. And it turns out that if f is increasing, an increasing function, then the integral turns out to be really simple. It's just a double integral. First you integrate with respect to y from A, is that right? Oh, I guess you're integrating with respect to x from a to y, and then integrating with respect to y, right? And you could even write it as a single integral if you want to. You could write it as 2ab f of x b minus b minus x. So for an increasing function, this quantum integral, this turns out to be this ordinary Riemann integral here. And similarly, if it's decreasing. And I'll give you a couple of examples. For example, x to the n, n non-negative. So that's increasing, so I can write it in this way, and it turns out to be that. So it's kind of like integrating twice. If a is 0, that makes it simpler. If a is 0, all that stuff goes away there. So it's just b to the n plus 2 times 2 to n plus 1, n plus 2. It's sort of like twice the double integral, integrated twice. Compared to the usual integral, this would just be b to the n plus 1 divided by n plus 1. You do it again, essentially, and multiply by 2. And the integral of an exponential, which is also increasing, turns out to be this. As you see, again, if a is 0, this goes away. No, I guess it's a minus 2 there. Yeah, minus 2b. Well, this is a little more complicated. But anyway, it's sort of like doing the exponential twice. And similarly for e to the x to the minus n. So that's just a little example. Okay, so I talked about measure and integration. Now I want to talk about and homomorphic logics. Yes?
As I kept to the end, I was wondering if you thought about expectation values and things.
Well, yeah.
Mass and whether that would have a correct physical meaning.
Yeah, yeah, right. That's a good question. So we can think of this integral as the expectation, a quantum expectation.
Yes.
Yeah. And of course, this quantum expectation is going to be different than an ordinary expectation. It's not going to have some of the properties like additivity. But I've got a little result, at least in, I've been looking at coins, flipping coins, and I've been thinking about a quantum coin, which would be, I took the usual probability and squared it and called that a quantum coin. Of course, there are different ways of doing it. You probably use an amplitude and get a quantum coin too. But anyway, for that simple quantum coin, then I looked at the expectations, and the expectations, of course, are different than your ordinary coin, but it turns out that if you flip more and more times, the expectation approaches the classical expectation. It's kind of interesting. So it's kind of a quantum law of large numbers, that in large numbers of flips, it will reproduce the classical result.
So whether it would reproduce quantum expectation values for things like, if you just took the quantum measure from some quantum system you understand and asked for expectation value of a particle being in a certain place at a certain time, whether it would give you back what you normally get?
I suspect it would be different, yeah. Just like this quantum measure is not the same thing as a quantum probability in the usual quantum mechanics, so it would be different, but it may be some kind of approximation in the long run. I don't know. Yeah, I haven't looked at that much. Yeah. Okay, and homomorphic logics. So from now on, I'll just restrict myself to a finite sample space. So here's your finite sample space. And then we'll take the events just to be the power set, all the subsets of this set. And we'll let Z2 be the two-element Boolean algebra with usual multiplication and addition modulo 2. And then we'll call a co-event, a function from the set of events to the two-element Boolean algebra. And just to get rid of a pathological situation, I don't want to have it to be 1 on the empty set. So these are all of the truth functions, say, that are 0 on the empty set. And co-events correspond to potential realities for a physical system. If A is affirmed, that is, phi of A is 1, then A occurs. And if phi of A is 0, then A does not occur. So this corresponds to kind of a logic for your physical system. And if we happen to be in a classical system, say in classical mechanics, then this truth function would be a homomorphism, a usual logical homomorphism. It would satisfy the three properties that one would have in logic, phi of the whole space is 1, that's called the unital condition. Phi of the disjoint union would be the sum of the phis, additivity. Phi of the intersection is a product of the phis, that's called a multiplicative property. So if you're in a classical system, then it would be one of these homomorphisms. But there are many examples of quantum systems that aren't classical, in which you do not have these classical truth values. When you have interference, like in 2-slit or 3-slit experiments, then you don't have this homomorphism. So you have something more general. Some of these properties fail for quantum systems. So it's no longer a homomorphism. So that, for that reason, we'll call the set of all of these, all of the possible truth functions, the full and homomorphic logic. You know, they can include things that aren't homomorphisms, so we'll call them an anhomomorphic logic. And, of course, these are essentially all of the 0, 1 functions on here, except those that vanish at the empty set. So there's a huge number of these functions, 2 to the 2 to the n minus 1. So it's a very large number of points in this anhomomorphic logic. And just to look at get a handle on them, let's take the simplest ones called the evaluation map, omega I star. Omega I star is 1 on A if and only if A contains omega I, essentially a delta function. And one can show that the homomorphisms are precisely these evaluation maps. And so in classical reality, there are only n possibilities, and only n possible realities in the classical system, namely these omega i's, these n omega i's, stars. But in quantum mechanics, we can have a lot more possible realities. So we'll take these take any old coevent. These are called coevents. We define the sum in the usual way, and the product in the usual way, and you can then write any coevent as a polynomial in these evaluation maps. And now let's look at various kinds of coevents. Coevent is additive, that's that second property. Phi of the union is the sum of the phis, circle sum of the phis. And one can show that the additive ones are precisely of this form. They're combinations, additive combinations of the evaluation maps. CIs are 0 or 1s. So all of the additive maps we'll call the additive logic. And there are 2 to the n additive coevents. And the multiplicative ones, the one that satisfies the third condition there, those have to be of this form here, products of evaluation maps. And the set of multiplicative coevents we'll call the multiplicative logic. And there are 2 to the n of those, too. And another type which is of interest are the quadratic or grade 2 coevents, those that satisfy this here. That's corresponding to that grade 2 additivity for measures. Only now we have to use circle sum, Boolean sum. And one can show that phi is quadratic if and only if it's a second degree polynomial in the evaluation maps. And here's the quadratic logic. Those consist of all the quadratic coevents. And there are 2 to the n, n plus 1 over 2 of those. That's cardinality of that anhomomorphic logic. Okay, so I talked about quantum measure and integration. I talked about anhomomorphic logics. Is there a connection between those two fields, is the question. And I think there is. So I'm going to talk about now a connection between those two areas. The first one is talk about transferring quantum measures. So let's say, let's first of all look at a couple of quantum measures. Take a good old delta function, concentrated at a point, omega I. Now we're always in a finite set here. And so that's an ordinary measure, and so it's a quantum measure. And if you take the product of two delta functions, delta measures, then that's no longer a measure, but it's a quantum measure. You can see it's not a measure, right? Because this acting on omega I is zero, in fact, the omega j is zero, but acting on the two-point set, omega I, omega j is one, so it doesn't add up. So it's not a measure, but it's easy to see that is a quantum measure. And now we'll look at the sine quantum measures. So those are just the ones that satisfy this grade 2 additivity, but they can be negative. And those clearly form a linear, real linear space. And it turns out that these deltas and the product of deltas form a basis for that space. So the dimension of this linear space is the number of these things. And so that's n of these, and n choose 2 of those. So it's n plus 1 over 2. So we've got this nice finite dimensional space. And now I'm going to define a quantum measure to be pure if it only has two values, 0 and 1. And there are lots of examples of pure quantum measures. These deltas are two of them, two different kinds of examples, but there are others. Now let's look at the set of Q measures that are bounded by 1. And yeah, so those are all the Q measures that are bounded above by 1. You can always turn a Q measure into one that's bounded by 1, just divide it by its maximum value, if you want to. So this is all of them that are bounded by 1. And now we'll let P of A n be all the pure quantum measures. Remember, those are the measures with just values 0 and 1. And we'll denote by extm the extreme points, extreme elements of this convex set. And it turns out that the extreme elements are the same thing as the pure ones. Pure ones, the 0, 1 measures, quantum measures, are exactly the extreme points. Then you can use the Krein-Milman theorem, because this is a compact set, compact convex set, since it's finite dimensional. And from the Krein-Milman theorem, it would follow then that any quantum measure is a non-negative combination of pure quantum measures. And that will be useful for this transference result that I'm going to talk about in a second. Before I do that, I need to find a pure event, so pure co-event. So if you have a co-event that happens to be a quantum measure, then we call that a pure co-event. So the pure co-events are those truth functions that happen to also be quantum measures. Not all of them do that. And so given a pure measure, thinking of it as a map into the Boolean algebra, then that would be a pure co-event. And conversely, given a pure co-event, then thinking of it as, given a pure measure, then you can think of it as a co-event. So they go back and forth. So there's a one-to-one correspondence between the pure quantum measures and the pure co-events. And we'll denote the set of pure co-events by A and P star. We'll call that the pure anhomomorphic logic. And there's, just to give an example, if you have a three-element set, there are 34 pure co-events out of a total of 128 possible co-events. And here's some examples of pure co-events. Something like this, omega 1 star, or sum, omega 1 star plus omega 2 star, product, this kind, or this kind, or this kind. Those are all examples of pure co-events. An example of one that's not pure is one like this, omega 1 star plus omega 2 star plus omega 3 star. That's not pure, because you look at what this does to the whole space, it's 1, because there's an odd number there. But if you look at the pairs here, the doubled in sets, it's 0 here, 0 there, 0 there, 1 there, 1 there, 1 there. You get minus 3 instead of 1. So it's not a quantum measure. So that's an example of a non-pure one. Anyway, one can show that every pure co-event is quadratic. That's what that says. But it doesn't go the other way. There are quadratic ones that aren't pure. For example, this one here is quadratic. It's not pure. So here's the definition. We say that a quantum measure transfers. So you have a quantum measure on AN, and you take a sub-homomorphic logic of your full homomorphic logic, then it transfers to AN naught star. If there's an ordinary measure on the power set of AN star naught, such that this holds. And this is a natural thing, because if you take an event A, then you look at the co-events, all the co-events, the anhomomorphic logic. Then that's kind of the dual of your original space, right? Those are the truth functions. And so the dual of an event would be all of the co-events that are one on that event, all the co-events that affirm that event. So you could think of an event here in your event space, and it's dual in the anhomomorphic logic. That's all of the two functions that are one there, so that would be like the dual of the event. And so this just tells us that mu of A is the same thing as nu of the dual of A. So it's a natural condition to want. And so this would be nice if you could do this, because here you've got this quantum measure, and it corresponds to the dynamics of your quantum system in the history approach. This corresponds to probabilities of histories, or propensities of histories, which is, gives you the dynamics of your situation. And so this would, if you could transfer mu over to here, then that would mean that you could transfer your quantum measure to an ordinary measure on a bigger system, but in some sense you could transfer a quantum dynamics to a classical dynamics, and maybe be easier to understand what's going on there. Who knows? Anyway, that's what I'm saying. Also, it has another nice attribute, and that's the following. If mu of A happens to be zero, then of course this side is zero. So all of the phis that are one on A have measure zero. So those are not regarded. They're just kind of dispensed with. And this is a kind of a preclusivity that Raphael talks about a lot, if phi of A is 1, then it's not preclusive. So the only ones that are preclusive are the co-events that are 0 on A. So that says that this measure here is concentrated on the preclusive co-events. So that's a nice attribute of this. Okay, so here's the main theorem. Yeah, if you have a anhomomorphic logic that's big enough to contain the pure anhomomorphic logic, then any quantum measure will transfer from AN to AN naught star. And here's, I won't go through this in detail, but here's a one-line proof if you want to. It just relies on that previous theorem that any quantum measure is a positive linear combination of the pure ones, and so you take mu and it transfers to this nu here. You take that same combination, but you concentrate them at these pure ones. And that's why you need the pure co-events for this to work. And also, it goes the other way. If you have any old measure you want on the pure anhomomorphic logic, then it comes from some quantum measure. And, well, maybe I'll skip this just to get on. Let's just look at 4.8. That says that, if a quantum measure transfers to the multiplicative anhomomorphic logic, then it's zero on practically everything. It says it's zero on all of the multiplicative co-events except for the quadratic ones. And as a corollary of this, one can show that you can't transfer any old quantum measure to the multiplicative anhomomorphic logic like you can to the pure one or the quadratic one. Okay, one other subject I want to talk about, and that is reality filters. So we're trying to find out what quantum reality is. And quantum reality is supposed to be one of these truth functions. one of these truth functions is supposed to describe what really happens in the world. And we're trying to figure out which one it is. So reality filter I think of as a filter you put through truth functions, and it filters a lot of them out. And so there'll just be a few. And those are maybe closer to reality than we had before. And okay, well, we may need another filter. Filter some of those out and get closer to reality. So we keep filtering, and eventually, supposedly, we're going to get one truth function, and that is the quantum reality. So there are various truth functions that people use, and let me tell you various filters that people have used. Let me tell you about a few of them. First of all, this is the one that I invented, and it comes from this quantum integral. And it goes as follows. Remember, we were able to integrate with respect to a quantum measure, but we could just as well integrate with respect to a coevent if we want to. And we use the same definition. If you have a coevent, we'll integrate with respect to that coevent. Same formula that we had before. Instead of a measure, we have a coevent here, but that's just zeros and ones. So that's a good old function. We could integrate using that function. And so we can integrate with respect to coevents. And as usual, the integral of a function over a set is the integral of the function times its characteristic function of that set. Let me give you a couple of examples of quantum integrals with respect to coevents. Not surprisingly, if you integrate a function with respect to this delta coevent, this homomorphism, you just get the function back again at that point. So it's not interesting at all. So there's no reason to have integration in the classical situation. Nobody would consider classical integration because all you get is the function evaluated at the point. That doesn't tell you a thing. Are we going through a little earthquake here? Okay, so that one's simple. Let's say we integrate with respect to one of these multiplicative coevents. Then that integral turns out to be something pretty simple. It's just the minimum of the values of the function, turns out. Let's say we order the values of the function. If you integrate with respect to this sum, this additive coevent, turns out to be something a little strange. It's the biggest value minus the next biggest value plus the next biggest value minus the, so it's a, all the values summed and differences in order of their size. Okay, now this is a particular filter that Raphael is very started and very important for him and other people, and it's the following. We say that an event is mu precluded if its measure is zero. So sets of measure zero are called precluded events. And a coevent is preclusive if it's zero on precluded events. So those are the preclusive ones. So you could think that of that as a filter. You take in your coevents, you filter out those that are not preclusive. And so you get a bunch coming out that are preclusive. But one thing about that is there's still a lot of them. There's a huge number that are preclusive, and so we still need more information, usually, in order to identify the one actual reality. And so this filter that I'm going to propose here is stronger than preclusive. It filters out more coevents. Okay, so that's this thing here we're trying to do. It. Other ways of filtering out coevents is to say, okay, I think that the coevents, the actual coevents should be additive, so I'll use this filter. I'll filter out all those that aren't additive. Or maybe it should be multiplicative. I'll filter out all those that aren't multiplicative. So there's another. Or maybe you think they should be quadratic, so I'll filter out those that aren't quadratic, or maybe they should be pure. So those are various reality filters. So I want to describe one reality filter that I've come up with here, which is the following. A function, as usual, is symmetric if f of omega ij is equal to f of omega ji for every I and j. Now, we'll say that a quantum measure generates a coevent if there exists a strictly positive symmetric function such that the measure is the integral, the double integral of that function over the set A. So you integrate with respect to phi, with respect to the first variable over A, so that gives you some number, then you integrate again, and that gives you another number. So this is saying that the measure is kind of an average over the reality phi. So you're averaging over some reality, and that gives you your original quantum measure. So mu generates phi if mu can be written as an integral with respect to phi. And we call this F a density. So there's various questions. That is, does mu generate anything? Or given a phi, is there a mu that generates it? And I'll talk about those in a minute. Anyway, I've got a little theorem that says that if mu generates phi, then phi is preclusive. So it'll only generate preclusive ones. So this makes it a stronger filter than preclusivity. One problem, of course, is that sometimes it's so strong that it won't generate anything. So it'll be a filter and nothing's going to get through. So it's not perfect, that's for sure. And also a question about uniqueness. If they're quadratic, then it's unique. If phi and psi are both quadratic and mu generates both of them, then they have to be the same. So for quadratic co-events, what you get out is unique. There's only one. If it generates anything, it'll only generate one. And maybe I'll skip this. This says that this is really a quantum phenomenon, this generation. In other words, if mu happens to be an ordinary measure, then it's not going to generate anything except for very simple ones. Things like this, those are the only ones that generate. And they have to be concentrated at two points in order to generate something. Okay, and also this shows that it doesn't generate a lot of co-events, namely a lot of the multiplicative ones are not generated, which would make Raphael unhappy. It says if a co-event has degree larger than 2, in other words, a co-event, all of its terms have degree larger than 2, then it can't be generated. So these big ones with high degrees aren't generated. And a multiplicative co-event is not generated unless it's quadratic. So it's closely related to quadratic. Also, you might ask, I think that's in the next slide. Yes, why not have a simpler way of doing it? In other words, I had that double integral. Why not define generation in this way, in terms of just a single integral? Well, if you do that, you're not going to get much generated. So it's too simple. And if you try to generate a co-event in terms of a single integral, you won't get many co-events that way. And one reason for that is because in order to describe this quantum measure, a quantum measure is determined by its values on singleton and doubleton sets. So in order to describe a general quantum measure, you'll need n plus 1 over 2 pieces of information. And a function just gives you n pieces of information. While if you have a function of 2 variables that I'm doing, it gives you exactly n plus 2, n plus 1 over 2 pieces of information in general. So it gives you enough information to determine your measure. So that's one. Two reasons why I need a double integral. Okay, let me just end with a couple of questions. Does every quantum measure generate at least one co-event? So given an arbitrary quantum measure, can you find one of these density functions so that it generates a co-event? Another is, given a co-event, is it generated by at least one quantum measure? Another one is, if mu generates phi, is phi unique? Would this be filter out everything except for one? If phi is generated by mu, is mu unique? Take a density function. If phi is a phi density for mu, if f is a phi density function, is f unique? Well, one can give examples to show the answers of 1, 2, 4, and 5 are no. Those are all no. Actually, the most interesting one is 3, and that I'm not too sure about. I mentioned that if they were both quadratic, then they're unique. But in general, I don't know whether phi is always unique, no matter what mu is. And there are other questions that one might ask, but I'm going to stop there. Thank you. Oh, great, yes.
And this one's from Woody Allen.
Oh, good.
It says, without reality, where could you find a good steak?
A good steak. Yes, okay. Yes.
Have you ever had a Q-steak?
So the comment on Q3, that would be an awful lot to hope for. If phi were unique, that would be saying that just knowing the measure, which is basically like saying just being able to write down the depth interval, because the measure is some sort of simple, this quantum measure is some sort of very direct generalization of a path integral.
Then it would give you a unique
reality.
If you were
able to write that down, you would get a unique reality of it.
Yes, yeah, that would be too much to ask.
I mean, it would be great if it were true, but on the other hand...
Yeah, I haven't even found a counterexample where there are two that work. As I say, if they're both quadratic, then I know they're the same. But I haven't found a counterexample.
Examples where there are... So you found no example where there's more... For a fixed measure, mu, there's more than one phi.
Yeah.
I don't.
But maybe I haven't looked hard enough, probably. You think that if you start moving this, changing the density function, then you get other phis. But I haven't been able to find an example.
Should you be able to make one just by having a system with symmetry in it?
The trouble is that these integrals are so hard to do. I haven't gotten past three-element sets. If I get the four-element set, maybe I'll find one. But I have a terrible time computing these quantum integrals because they're messy. Yes.
Do you think something could be said about the theory of stochastic processes with respect to quantum measures?
I'm sure there's a whole field there, but I haven't looked into it. Except, I guess what we're talking, this Hopper example, I guess, things like that, where you have a simple, very simple random walk, quantum random walk, we've looked at. But, and of course, the whole theory of histories, but I don't know if you think of those as stochastic processes, maybe. I mean, people have looked at history, and that's within this framework.
Yeah, in a certain sense, I think, or at least I like to think of quantum mechanics, is precisely what you said. It's a stochastic kind of, it's a kind of quantum version of a stochastic process. But maybe you're asking something more in connection with this formula.
Like a process that has a quantum measure in time.
Well, so that is quantum mechanics. The Schrodinger equation, for example. You can think of this measure, which wasn't written down in that case, but you could think of that this quantum measure as a generalization of the Wiener measure.
Mm-hmm.
And in some sense, I think that's closer to. I think, for many purposes, that's a better analogy than thinking of quantum mechanics as a generalization of classical deterministic Hamiltonian mechanics. A lot of the formal and physical structure of the quantum formalism seems to be, from one point of view, which is essentially the path integral point of view or the history's point of view, seems to be better thought of it as a theory of a random process. The kind of mathematical things one writes down are generalizations of the classical stochastic. And in fact, in the strict sense, that if you write down a general scheme of quantum measures, then a special case of it is a classical stochastic process.
And also one of the motivations one of the big motivations behind this is the history's approach to quantum mechanics And this way of looking at things gives you a closer way of viewing the situation, closer to classical situations than quantum mechanics. And this may be more compatible with general relativity than the quantum mechanical way of looking at it. In other words, the Hilbert space, usual Hilbert space quantum mechanics, doesn't look a lot like general relativity. But if you transfer it into this quantum measure way of looking at it, then it's closer to general relativity. So maybe there's a way of unifying using this approach.
So can you comment a little bit more on potential interpretations of these measures and this set omega of underlying things and the events?
Well, my way of thinking about it, okay, you got your set omega, so those are your outcomes, you know, traditional outcomes and traditional events. And then you've got mainly a decoherence functional, which is gives you a measure of the interference between these. So somehow you get a measure out of how much an event interferes with itself. That's what mu A is, right? Mu of A would be the measure of how much it interferes with itself. And so this is related to the propensity of this occurring, what's the tendency of this measure, this event occurring. But I have no great intuition about it. It's counterintuitive in that it doesn't act like an ordinary probability theory, so I don't know how to interpret.
For instance, as fine-grained histories?
An element of omega.
Yes. Yeah.
The points of omega.
Maybe some finer approximation to trajectory or something. Or?
Well, it is the trajectory. Yeah, it's a fine grained history, as you said. If you use that language.
Where, for instance, you might even specify like position and momentum.
Well, it depends what your notion of history is. Well, so a typical history wouldn't have. History would be. It might be, for example, if you're thinking of particle mechanics. History would be a trajectory, let's say.
So just position.
So various paths.
It might be a Brownian type trajectory, so it wouldn't have a world of time for everything. So it'd be just giving the position as a function of time. If you were doing general relativity, say some continuum version of general relativity, then history would be a space-time. Or more mathematically speaking, it would be a diffeomorphism equivalence class of Lorentzian metrics and some manifold. So that would be a history. If you were doing pure electromagnetic field, a single history that is an element of omega would be just a mapping of space-time into, it would be a two-form valued field of space-time, or one-form, really better one